Who will be the top consumer watchdog?
Well, the White House might sidestep the controversy.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hi, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. It's the midday update from Marketplace.org, and it's Thursday, September 16th. The Harvard Law professor whose idea it was to create a Consumer Finance Protection Bureau will get a shot at setting it up. Proteins tend to do a body good, but what about the taste buds? Or did I say taste bugs? Yeah. That's later. But first,
it looks like the White House will pick Elizabeth Warren to head the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, you know, the one set up under the financial reform law. But apparently, Warren will not have to go through the usual Senate confirmation process. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning.
There's been a lot of speculation that Elizabeth Warren would get this job, but she is controversial. Remind us why.
Well, Warren is head of the congressional panel that investigated the Wall Street bailout, the TARP program, as it's known. And at hearings on TARP, she's been a vocal critic of both the financial sector and the federal government. She's also an outspoken consumer advocate. She actually came up with the idea for a Consumer Protection Bureau. She has been a no-holds-barred critic of financial institutions that she says are bilking consumers. And here she is in a clip talking in a video produced by a consumer group in favor of financial reform.
Companies have learned to compete by putting nominal interest rates and free gifts in big print, then packing the real revenue enhancers, a whole bucket of tricks and traps, in incomprehensible fine print.
Now, Bill, banks hear that kind of talk and they freak out. They think Warren would curb their ability to impose fees on consumers, what she calls revenue enhancers. And they're worried there would be lots of new regulations they'd have to comply with. Many Republicans in Congress agree, and that is why President Obama is expected to bypass the normal confirmation process. Usually these types of appointments do have to be approved by the Senate, but it doesn't look like enough senators would actually support Warren.
But how much sway could Warren have if she's made an unofficial appointee?
Well, like you say, she would be unofficial, but she would still be the architect of the new Consumer Protection Bureau. It was her brainchild, and she would be the one setting it up. And she would have the power to recruit staff, and she would be the public face of the bureau. She would be called an assistant to President Obama and Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner. But just because her position would be unofficial doesn't mean she wouldn't eventually be named as the official director.
Okay, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer in Washington. Thanks.
You're welcome.
The number of people who filed last week for first-time unemployment claims fell for the third straight week. The Labor Department today said that number dropped slightly by 3,000 to 450,000. Mark Vitner is a senior economist at Wells Fargo. He's with us from Detroit this morning. Hi.
Good morning.
We keep dropping, if ever so slightly. Is it wrong to think that the worst is over?
Well, it does look like we're seeing some improvement. The level of jobless claims has fallen to its lowest level in 2 months, but it's still relatively high. 450,000 claims, that works out to 1.8 million jobs being lost in a month's time.
How many jobs, Mark, does the economy need to be adding to really get the momentum going, get some steam under this?
On a net basis, we need to add at least 150,000 jobs to start bringing down the unemployment rate.
150,000 a month or...?
A month. And that means that since we're losing somewhere around 1.8 million to 2 million, a little bit, about 1.8 million a month, we need to add 2 million jobs a month or create 2 million new jobs a month to offset all the jobs that we're losing and create enough net new jobs to reduce the unemployment rate.
And the takeaway, just the overall takeaway of this report?
Well, it's better than expected. A lot of people were thinking the number would rebound a little bit because we've seen some improvement. We've come down from a high of 500,000 a few weeks ago, which is very problematic and got a lot of people worried about a double dip or a sliding back into a recession. That doesn't seem likely right now.
All right. Mark Vitner, senior economist at Wells Fargo in Detroit. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
While jobless benefits fell slightly last week, FedEx is going the other way. Let's welcome senior economist Josh Shapiro with the economics research firm MFR in New York. Hello.
Good morning.
FedEx said this morning it's closing 100 facilities, cutting loose 1,700 people. I thought global companies were the ones in good shape. Is the developing world not the job-producing growth engine we hoped?
Well, I think that the developing world is still very clearly dependent on economic conditions in the developed world, which is a much larger swath of the global economy. And with conditions remaining very weak in industrialized economies, it's very tough, I think, to expect the developing world to be the engine of growth. And FedEx is responding to this by cutting costs, as are a lot of other companies. And unfortunately, labor is the main cost for any company. And it's like we're likely to see, as companies try to maintain profitability, continued difficult conditions in labor markets.
We'll hope for better. Senior economist Josh Shapiro with the economics research firm MFR. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
President Obama's pick for director of the White House Office of Management and Budget is Jacob Lew, nicknamed Jack, and he'll be a familiar face to many senators asking him questions today. He was OMB director for President Clinton, as Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
The OMB director is responsible for the president's budget, and that will automatically provoke administration critics. But Larry Haas, who worked with Jack Lew at OMB, says he's well-liked in Congress.
But there's no question Republicans will see his nomination hearings as an opportunity to focus attention on big deficits of the last few years, health care reform, and the like.
Among Lew's challenges will be improving morale in the office. In the latest rankings of the best places to work in government, OMB dropped from third best to 25th. Gary Bass is with OMB Watch.
Jack will come in with much stronger management skills and probably give much greater support to the civil service staff to do their work.
Senators will ask why Lew got almost a $1 million bonus when he left Citibank in 2009. That was after Citi got $50 billion in taxpayer help. At least one Republican wants to know if those are connected. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, September 16th. I'm Steve Chiatakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at marketplace.org. We're going to get a take on the global perspective now, what's happening in business and economics around the world and how it affects us here in the United States. Today, the Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner testifies before the Senate Banking Committee. He's going to say China's currency is purposely undervalued to boost its exports. Needless to say, that's been responsible for the outsourcing of American jobs. And the blame game, of course, is a huge election year issue. Europeans, meanwhile, are grappling with what to do about the cheap costs of Chinese goods. The EU claims fiberglass is being unfairly dumped into its markets. So today, the EU voted to tack on a huge tariff on the material, up from a 7% duty to more than 50% to offset the threat of jobs and production losses there. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is covering that story for us. He has the latest now from London. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
A fiberglass, really? I mean, how big an issue is this?
Well, it is a lightweight material, after all. It's not a huge industry. I mean, they use this in to make composites for wind turbines, car bodies, ship hulls, and so on. Not a gigantic market in Europe. It's worth about $1.5 billion a year. The Chinese have 15% of that market, but that's double what they had a couple of years ago. And the Europeans say they've grabbed that market share by dumping their products below cost price on the European market. I would say this is a symbolically important case. It puts the spotlight on EU-China trade relations. It shows the US isn't the only trade partner having trouble with the Chinese.
Yeah, we know, Stephen, about the trade deficit the US has with China, but what's the situation between China and the EU?
The EU's deficit is $160 billion a year. That's less than America's deficit, but it's growing. And there's the same kind of frustration here as in the US with the Chinese for allegedly holding down their currency, dumping cheap products, and its claim not appreciating that by not opening up their own markets more and stimulating their own consumer demand, they could be jeopardizing the global recovery. So EU-China trade relations definitely deteriorating.
And is this, Stephen, the beginnings of a trade war?
Too soon, I think, to talk about a trade war, but tensions are definitely building. Simon Tilford of the Center for European Reform says we probably can expect quite a few more measures like this extra tariff on fiberglass.
The Chinese, I think, need to acknowledge that the Europeans and the Americans now feel that they have pretty much exhausted other avenues and that they feel that they're going to have to adopt tougher measures against the Chinese authorities.
This week, a Chinese think tank warned that the U.S. would come off worse in a trade war with China. Tilford says that's nonsense. He says since China has upset both of its two biggest markets, it has the most to lose.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard reporting from London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
It's the Chinese version of eminent domain, government seizure of private property, and it's becoming more common. So much so, there's now an online video game devoted to it. The game pits angry homeowners struggling to hold on to their property against an evil demolition crew. It's become one of China's most popular online games. Marketplace China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports it's a sign the Chinese are getting fed up with losing their homes to more development.
Losing your home has never been so fun. The free online game allows you to throw slippers, firecrackers, and other household objects from an upstairs window at a demolition crew below. They're armed with shovels, bulldozers, and machine guns. Guess who wins? Chinese internet expert Wen Yunchao says he's not surprised the game's so popular.
There are so many vicious property seizures happening right now in China. And for many people, all this has reached an unbearable level.
China's rapid development and massive public works projects have forced millions from their homes. It's also spurred a public debate in China over property rights. Just this summer, the country began moving more than 300,000 people from their homes to clear the way for a massive water diversion project. Wen says more Chinese are being angered by the limited rights under Chinese law for people who face this type of forced relocation. Without this backdrop, he says, the game's pretty pointless. As pointless, perhaps, as defending your home against Chinese developers. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, September 16th. I'm Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, just go to the numbers at marketplace.org. Real estate data firm RealtyTrack is out with its foreclosure report for August, and really there's no way to sugarcoat this one. Defaults and repos up 4% from July's figures, as Janet Babin reports from North Carolina Public Radio.
RealtyTrack found that a lot of the same states keep topping the foreclosure list. Nevada was number one again for the 44th straight month. Florida and California remain among the top five. But the real estate data firm saw a new trend in August, foreclosure creep. Rick Sharga is a senior vice president with RealtyTrack.
The problem is now migrating along the lines of where we're seeing rates of unemployment increase. Places like Idaho and Oregon and Utah and most recently Washington State.
And while foreclosure rates in some places, like Florida, are down marginally from last year, Sharga says that drop is mostly from foreclosure prevention programs. Until the jobs picture brightens and consumer confidence returns, Sharga says we can expect the increase in foreclosures to continue. He does not expect a housing market recovery for at least 3 years. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Thousands of people will line the streets of Edinburgh, Scotland today as Pope Benedict XVI meets Queen Elizabeth. The bill for the Pope's visit will be paid by the British government, and that has many Brits upset, as the BBC's Rebecca Singer reports from London.
He's only the second pope to visit the UK in the last 500 years. But even before Benedict XVI touched down at Edinburgh Airport, his visit's been marred by controversy. The cost of this visit, $19 million for the British government, and the Catholic Church will be putting in another $15 million. But there's been a lot of criticism of these costs, at a time when the country is recovering from recession and facing big cuts to public spending. Juliet Wilson is from the Humanist Society of Scotland. She says taxpayers shouldn't have to foot the bill.
The Vatican, with their enormous wealth, should pay for that. Politicians need to understand that the teachings of the Pope are completely against the way that most Scottish people and even most Catholics think and live their lives.
But there have been some concessions. For the first time, people attending a beatification service on Sunday will have to pay $40 for tickets and transport. And the government has defended the cost, saying the Pope has been invited as a head of state. It notes that last year it cost more to host a one-day meeting of G20 finance ministers. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer for Marketplace.
The nation's birth rate dropped last year for a second year in a row. According to the National Center for Health Statistics, that birth rate number in 2009 was the lowest in a century. A lot of experts on the subject say the economy has a lot to do with that. Megan Sweeney is a sociologist at UCLA here in California, and she's here to talk about it this morning. Thanks for being with us.
No problem. Happy to be here.
In what ways does the economy dictate whether people have children?
First of all, I guess I'd back up and say that it's difficult to know exactly what's causing the change in birth rates at any given point in time. If you look historically over a long time period, birth rates tend to dip up or dip down, and it's difficult to know for sure that the economy is causing these changes. That said, there are a lot of reasons to think that they could be contributing factors. Children are expensive to raise. I have one myself. I know that's true. They also require care, and so often you'll have at least one of the parents out of the labor market for a period of time taking care of the child. In periods of economic instability, having two earners in the labor market can be a nice cushion. So that can be one of the reasons that people might choose to delay a birth.
What are some of the hazards of lower birth rates?
Well, I think we care about low birth rates because, all else equal, families having fewer children contributes to an aging population and a possible shortage of what demographers consider the all-important trifecta of workers, warriors, and consumers. And there's probably also some sense out there that people should be able to have the number of children that they want to have, particularly if they're willing and able to work to support them.
Have we seen this before, this kind of drop?
Yeah. So actually, if you look historically in the United States, there is a series of drops in the birth rate that coincide with recessionary periods. So the most dramatic one, obviously, is the Great Depression of the 1930s.
Right.
Fertility was low then. And then also we saw it, for example, in the early 1970s.
I can remember 10, 20 years ago, European countries were concerned about birth rates there, trying to get people to have kids again. Is this really a concern for our country?
Yeah, there's actually many European countries, Spain, Italy, France, have been very concerned about their low fertility and have been trying to come up with ways to encourage the members of their population to increase fertility. Of course, across all countries, the size of a population and its rate of growth depends not just on birth rates, but also on factors such as immigration patterns. And that's really important to keep in mind.
Dr. Megan Sweeney, Associate Professor of Sociology at UCLA, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much.
A new study says first-person shooter games, you know, those really gory, violent video games, could actually sort of be good for people.
Really?
You know, we're talking about games like Call of Duty.
Friendly spy plane inbound.
Yeah, that's a lot of machine gun fire right there.
Yes, it is. Too much.
Researchers at the University of Rochester tested folks who had never played a shooting video game before.
Half played a week's worth of the violent stuff. The other half played a more benign strategy video game. The study found that shooter games produced heightened sensitivity and more efficient use of people's senses.
And not to mention the ability to wage war from the most comfortable seat in the house.
Yeah, that's convenient
that's
there.
Right. And finally, the Wall Street Journal reports insect cuisine may finally be catching on in the United States. This weekend, a cooking store called the Brooklyn Kitchen will be serving wax moth larvae ceviche. Many people enjoy the crickets inside chocolate chirp cookies.
Yes, yes. And actress Selma Hayek tells David Letterman that lots of people in her native Mexico eat bugs.
Yes, we do.
You eat bugs.
Escamoles, which are the eggs of these little ants, and fried are amazing with a little bit of guacamole. And
critter fans say that it is the new sushi. You laugh, but high in protein, low in fat, plus it's cheap and environmentally friendly. So bug appetit. Yep. Eat it up, Steve. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.